very privileged to have a speaker that I met about 3 years ago, and she is just a wonderful person. I've enjoyed her so much. She has a good sense of humor and is a very loving person. Her name is Marjorie Wallace. She doesn't have any anonymity left anyhow. Because she is our Southeastern trustee. She is from Horse Cave, Kentucky. Marge is the mother of two sons. And as our regional trustee, her assignment at WSO is chairman of the policy committee, which automatically makes her a member of the executive and budget committee. And that makes her just a real good Al-Anon, just like the rest of us. Thank you, Marge.
Before I really think I should just sit down and not spoil all those things she said. She's just made it sound so good. Before I get through, you might change that. Hi, everybody. My name is Marge Wallace, and I'm a grateful recovering member of Al-Anon. And I want to tell you, my home group is in Mumfordville, Kentucky, which meets on a Thursday night at 7:30. I am also a sponsor of an Alateen group called the Yep Group. Young people, young adults. See, I haven't really let God have this yet. Youth of alcoholic parents. I got it. And I'm an Al-Anon member, I feel, because I practice this program that's been given to me. Not because I sit in a meeting. I'm not any more of an Al-Anon member because I sit in a meeting than a chicken is, that if I were to sit in a chicken coop and be called a chicken. And I firmly believe that I'm there because I practice that Al-Anon program that's been given to me. I've got several 24 hours, and I'm grateful to tell you that I have 21 years in Al-Anon. Now, that does not make me an authority, and all these things that she said about me, I'm still doing things that I was asked to do when I came into Al-Anon, and that was when I had something to give away, to give it away. And that's how I was going to grow. I didn't have my warm fuzzy that I had hung to. I think it had turned to a hard prickly. She told me that it would because I didn't give it away. So somebody gave me a fresh, good one, pure, clean, soft one this morning. So I've got another one. I'm grateful for that. I want to tell you how much that I appreciate the fact that you've asked me to come. I thank the committee who asked me to start building this Bridge to Understanding, which is a thing that I've had with you. And it started with the communication that I had. Can you hear me? Am I too close? There seemed to be a noise that I've been hearing. Is it okay this morning? Good. Thank you. But it was the communication that I had. And I think that if I were to say to you that the Bridge to Understanding that I've had in this program is because of communication. All my communication hasn't been good communication, but it's been communication in one form or another. A lot of times it was complete silence. Sometimes it was silence that was good, and sometimes it was bad silence. Have you ever done any of that? Sit there with them. You know, just look at you. You're just so uptight, and you're not going to say anything, and you dare somebody else to. So there's a lot of ways of communicating. Trip over here, a friend of mine came with me from Kentucky, and we had a lovely trip over here, and we anticipate another one going back. And this setting, and this morning I looked out and I said, there's just no doubt in your mind that God has everything in his pocket. And if I fall out, it's my fault, it's not his. And I'm so grateful for that this morning. I have a lot of gratitude, and I hope you'll hear that as I go along. I was also grateful for the fruit this morning in the room, particularly because I chose not to go out to have breakfast. So I had some of that fruit for breakfast. So you're sharing with me that way. You've shared with me your lives, the things that have been good, that you've cried, we've cried some tears together. And this is what my program's all about. When I was out there alone, I didn't have anybody to do those things with. And the most, I think the, I've often said to me, hell is a place where I'd have to be all alone and nobody there. Have you been all alone and nobody's there? How many times have you been all alone and there's nobody there? To me, that's what hell would be. Maybe that's not God's idea of it, but that's mine at this time in the sense of being alone. I am the only girl of 9 children. I had 4 brothers younger and 4 brothers older than I. You're right. That's a lot of fun. You sort of forget how to play with dolls and, you know, all that sort of thing. You have to play ball and you have to climb trees. And we lived on a farm. You had to ride horses and all those other good things that boys did if you wanted somebody to play with. And I did those things. And I got so good at it that when I went to school, they wouldn't even let me play on the girls' teams, because if it was baseball, I hit home runs and I pitched and I was pretty good and very many people didn't get it. And a couple of times I've doubled people over when I'd hit the ball so hard that I decided that I was out for vengeance maybe at that time. I don't know, but that's just the way that I did things. That's how my life was at that time. But that also left when I talked about the lonely things, it left some holes in my life that I've heard other people talk about here this weekend. And from the very beginning with Barbara and Stephanie and Gwen and Don, Peter, you've all, just with your sharing, given me so much, and I'm so grateful for that. And when I looked at you this morning, I didn't have to look out at you with fear in my heart. I saw a lot of you smiling at me, and I know you're saying prayers. I know you're with me. I know that's the reason why we're here together. But I heard my mother say a lot of times, I didn't understand it then, but it stuck with me, and why it stuck with me, I don't know, that another boy would have been fine. Yeah. You know what that did to me? I was second best. I had to try harder. So I started out second best to try harder. And I did that until I got into Al-Anon. And after I'd been in Al-Anon for a good while, I still tried to be first. I wanted to be first. And I found out you had to be first by knowing yourself and loving yourself. And I'm first, and then I'm first with God, as far as I'm concerned. And that was great for me to learn. In that sense of being that way, and I'm sure it was because my mother had an awful lot of responsibilities when you think about having that many children, and particularly boys, I grew up doing an awful lot of things, and guess what? I was a mother to 3 of these little boys that came along down here, and my maternal instinct started out early, taking care of other people, controlling other people. Why would I have not married an alcoholic? They needed me. They needed my care. They needed my protection. They needed the things that I had to offer them. I can really say, though, that we did have a loving family in the sense that of as much as they knew, were capable of doing at that time. I've sat in on a lot of your Al-Anon adult children's groups, and I identified with you right down the line, but I didn't have alcoholic parents. But I had a dysfunctional family. I had a lot of the same things that you had. Identical things that you had. I had a lot of the loneliness, and I had fears because I didn't have anybody to talk to. I had no communication in that sense. I had anxieties about things that I didn't know about because I didn't know where to go with them. It wasn't that my parents mistreated me. They gave me, I think, the best that they could at the time. But I came up with such an insecurity that even before I got to Al-Anon, I had to have some therapy, and that didn't have a thing in the world to do with alcoholism. Not a thing. I can remember that we had a cousin who was a little older than I was that used to come and visit us, and a lot of times when he came, he was sick. I didn't know. I mean, I thought he was a sick person. Today, I know why he was sick. He was drinking, and they took him upstairs in the boys' part of the house. We had this great big old colonial house because either my maternal grandparents or my paternal grandparents lived with me, with us, as a family from the time we were little bitty tykes. So I was always used to a lot of people. And you know, if the grandparents lived there, everybody else, all the aunts and uncles and nieces and nephews and grandchildren, everybody comes to see you. There weren't very many weekends at our house that weren't 25 or 30 to 40, 50 people at our house. I mean, we just did that. That's the way you did it. You slept on the floor when you ran out of beds. And we had a lot of beds at our house. You know, we had a lot of beds at our house. We cooked a lot of food at our house. And I think back on those things and I think, you know, my mother didn't have a lot of other time to give. She was busy. We also had help, but, you know, when you got that many people around, you need a lot of help besides the things that I would do. But I began early to, because I was had this insecurity and all this sort of thing, to people please. If I did things that pleased my parents or I did things that pleased my brothers, they learned it real fast. That in order to for me to do things with them, I had to do something for them. And I did it. I was the best shoe polisher. I should have been a shoe shine person. I was really good at that. You think about getting that many kids up and getting them off to church on Sunday morning. And we went to church. Let me tell you how we went to church. You know how old I am. We went in a wagon. When I was a little tyke, we used to get ready to go. And can you imagine? I don't know how many miles it was, but it took us, seemed me, like half of the day to get there and half a day to get back. But that was fun, too. You weren't going anywhere else anyway, you know. That was your social life. And I'm grateful for those times, too, because I look back and there were a lot of good times at that. But I used to polish those shoes and they'd brag on me what a good job I did. Sure, they bragged on me. They didn't want to do it themselves. And I did it. I thought that was great, you know, good shoe polisher. I also learned how to cook real well. My mother bragged on me, and so I got the job of cooking. So you can look at me and tell I'm pretty good. I like eat well. That sort of runs in my family, too. But all these things that I started out doing had nothing at all to do with alcoholism. They were just things that I grew up. This is the way I grew up. We went to school. Our parents saw to it that we were involved in school activities and community activities and all this sort of thing. You think, well, you know, that sounds like pretty normal kind of thing. And in that sense, it was. It didn't seem to bother the others, but it bothered me that I didn't fit someplace. I heard somebody talking about the other day about running off from home. I ran off from home, you know, a couple of times, but I just went up on the hill. I wasn't going very far. And it was horrible when I got back home. Guess what the boys said? I had to run and hide from them. You know, what do you think you're doing? You know, and all this kind of stuff. So they'd heap things on me. But when I really needed them for other things, they were there. I know that. But have you ever tried to go with a boy that you knew your parents wouldn't particularly like with that many brothers, knowing what's going on? I had to be a good girl. It wasn't maybe because I wanted to all the time, but I just sort of had to. But it was nice to know that they were there too at times, so that's good. But I these are the kind of things I grew up with. So as I say, you know, there was to be living with, deeply affected by someone's alcoholism in my childhood, no. There was always at least one bottle and maybe two, and it seems to me they were either half pints or pints. I don't even remember knowing what size they were that sat on the pantry shelf. But they were used for medicinal purposes, I was told, and they were used for when, you know, in the fall when you made boiled custard. It wasn't called eggnog then, it was called boiled custard because that's what it was, boiled custard. And the grown-ups, when they came, they would, you know, put some of this in that. And that was my first taste of alcohol. I thought, everybody likes this so well, I think I'll, you know, they told us we could try. And I thought, gee whiz, what did they ruin this stuff with that nasty tasting stuff? So that didn't appeal to me. But apparently it did, you know, to them because they did it. I know now that there were times, my father was a real quiet person. He didn't say a whole lot, but when he opened his mouth, it was well worth listening to. He didn't talk a great deal. Maybe there were too many of us around to talk and he didn't get a chance, I don't know. Sometimes I thought it was because my mother was one of those silent people, and I know now that I got this maybe in the sense from her that if I didn't say anything, nobody could blame me for anything. And you couldn't say that I said so-and-so, or you couldn't say that I told you to do so-and-so. I might have wanted to so badly in my heart that I was just dying to do it, but I wouldn't do it because if I did, you might not like me. And I didn't want you not to like me. I didn't want those people not to like me. I wanted to say what you wanted to hear, and I tried to do that. So here I am, you know, starting out like this kind of a thing. Talking about my father, I know that we used to have some friends that came down from southern Indiana down to go hunting in the fall, bird hunting and rabbit hunting. I was good with a gun, too. I could shoot them just the suckers as fast as they could. I go out there with them. You get that many people out in a field where there's rabbits, somebody's going to run one up, and it's the first fellow that gets a crack. But we were always told that everybody had to stay in line back here. Nobody goes out here and nobody does that when you've got that many people around. But anyway, they used to come down to go hunting, and I knew my dad had the best time of those people, and I wish they'd come more often. You know, his tongue got a little loose, and he talked, and he laughed a lot. I found out later my dad was having a few drinks. That's the reason why he talked. But it was nothing excessive. And I never felt that there was any, after I realized what alcoholism was, you know what they called it when I was growing up? They were drunkards. They didn't take care of their families. They lied. They didn't support their families. And they were just no good, and you just avoided those people. You didn't have a thing in the world to do with them. I made a complete 180 degree turn in that situation. Last time I took my husband to the hospital, he was drunk, and I went in with all the love and compassion for that soul of anybody could have. Now, I used to be afraid of those people, and I believed what I'd been taught, that they were no good, they didn't do those things. I know that now that alcoholism is the disease, the effects and the things that you do, are the results of that. And they're not good things. Why would we all be so sick with it if they were good? But I was told that when I grew up, that's another thing, you know, if boys drank, I wasn't supposed to go with any boy who drank. And as I told you, you know, these guys watched out. I realized that not the older boys, but the younger boys, the ones who were younger than I, seemed to pick up the habit of having a drink once in a while when they were in school. Of course, by that time I was married and away from home. And I now have a brother, the one who is next youngest to me, that will be celebrating his third birthday tomorrow. And I'm grateful for that. You know who my family gives credit for that? Me. They think I did that. You know, the reason why they think that I did it was because when he moved out on his family and just left and couldn't and still hasn't been able to go back and make a lot of amends, but that's his program, and when the time comes, he will. They took him to a hospital, and they called me, and they said, "What are we going to do?" I said, "They've locked him up, and you won't see him. Nobody's going to see him for 6 weeks. I said, "Where is he?" They said, "He's in the VA hospital down in Murfreesboro, Tennessee." And I said, "How long's he been there?" And I said, "Well, one of the boys took him today, this morning." And I said, "How bad a shape was he?" And they said, "Well, he'd been sober for 2 or 3 days, but he was about to go into DTs. And he decided himself that he needed to be hospitalized." And I hung up the phone from that, and I called the hospital down there, and I told them who I was and would they have him call me. And in 5 minutes, he called me back. See, they don't understand. They don't know that. He called me back, and I told him that I knew he was there, and I loved him, and the time would come when I would be able to see him, and would he call me back if he could. And he did, and I visited him while he was down there. And it was a different story. They didn't know how I got in, though. They couldn't get in. They thought that he was locked up there. He was put away for 6 weeks with nobody to see him. Wasn't true at all. So, but they gave me credit for, you know, they continued. And I say, no, no, no. It was his decision. He made the decision, and I was there to help him. And I was there because I had had Al-Anon, and I had had the love, the support that you gave to me that I was able to help him with. And I'm so grateful for that today. That's one of the alcoholics in my life that I talked to you about. I married after finishing my high school and going on to college. I didn't finish because I met the man that was going to make me eternally happy. Happy ever afterwards. Isn't that a big responsibility to lay on somebody's shoulders? Isn't that a big responsibility? I thought I was going to do the same thing for him, though, see. I thought I had that power, too. In this marriage, there were two boys. And there was no alcoholism in this marriage. We live in the, somebody said something about the Bible Belt. And I had always gone to Sunday school and church. My mother played the organ or the piano, and my daddy led the singing, and all the little McReynolds, they sat on the front seat and sang, you know. That's the way you kept them out of mischief. You didn't let them sit on the back seat. You couldn't control them, you know. You set them up here, and they had to learn to sing. We had a lot of good times around the piano and the organ at home doing that kind of thing, too. That's the thing I continued to do. But this knowing and this hole in my gut of insecurity was still there. I brought it into that marriage. Nobody gave it to me in the marriage, and I brought it in with me. These boys came along, beautiful. I only have one, and I'll later tell you about the cause of only having one now that is living. In that period of time, I did the things that most of us do as a mother and as parents and that kind of thing. We had a business, and I worked in this business. Now, this was during the war, and we got out of that, and then we went into the wholesale business. And back in those days, and this was like about 58, 59, I was a sales lady on the road. You didn't do that very much. Women didn't then. First person that had anything smart to say to me about it was a man. He said, what are you doing out here? You know, why aren't you at home with your children? And I said, well, I got one of them with me and my husband's got the other one. And then I looked at him and I thought, I don't have to explain that to him. I should not be telling him this. But I didn't want him to think badly of me. So I explained. After a period of, let's see, I had always, because I had all these brothers, my husband had a brother. I wanted a little girl so badly, and I knew that I'd been a good enough girl, a good enough mother, that I deserved a little girl. I deserved that. I need a little girl in my life. But at the age of 29, God just decided that I didn't need any more children, and I had to have some emergency surgery, and I wasn't able to have any more children. This was the first time that I can say to you that I consciously said to God, why me? I don't understand. And I had a lot of grief over that. And it took me a good while. All these insecurities that I talked about roll back on me again. And I'm not good enough. I haven't done things right. And God's punishing me. And why? And it took me about, I was... The surgery in itself, I had what they call a surgical menopause. I went through all of that kind of thing that later in life you do if it's a natural thing. And this plus all the other things that were happening to me, I felt my life was falling apart. I wasn't doing a very good job of the things that I wanted to do. And I felt like that I wasn't, listen to this, I wasn't in charge all the time. And I wanted to be in charge all the time. I always think maybe that's the reason why I didn't drink very, you know, never drank to excess. Somebody else was going to be in charge, and I don't want anybody else in charge of me. But these things began to really grow on me, and I talked to a doctor, and I was beginning to get, you know, more so. So he suggested I might want to go to a psychiatrist, and he suggested one, and I'm eternally, will be eternally grateful for that. That was the first time in my life that somebody had say, whoa, wait a minute, look inside and see what's inside. I heard somebody talking about like peeling layers off of an onion. This is what they did with me. I liken it to having an infection way down deep. And until I could get down there and get to the root of that, it was going to stay there. It would keep showing up, and the results would be there from one place or another. But he helped me to do that. But you know what? He didn't, after I got through this, I could see that, but what was I going to do with it? I didn't have anybody to tell about what was going on. I didn't have anybody to share with in that situation. And I used to think of, I think now of the prayers that I prayed and the things that I asked for. They weren't supposed to be there then. They came in God's time, not in my time. I wasn't ready for them, and I know that. It wasn't pleasant at that time necessarily. We were in this business, as I was talking about, and my husband got developed cancer. We were building a home, and we had this business, and I suffered the very same things from this disease that I suffered from alcoholism. After his death, which was a short period of time, and it was as expensive then as it is today. We had insurance, but eventually it did not cover it. Our oldest son was married, had two children. I was stopping to think. And I was advised after his death to allow him to take over the business. He took it into bankruptcy. I lost my home, and I lost that thing of depending on, I mean, thinking God turned his back on me again. What have I done to deserve this? Well, you know what I did? I got back in charge again. I went to work at two jobs. I had to support this other family. My oldest son literally fell apart when his father died. Without too much help from any direction, he just chose to not do anything. Nothing at all. Sit there day after day. And I know today, and even in that sense, we had a lot to share. And we got closer. My youngest son was finishing high school, and he wanted to be an architect, and he didn't think it was fair that Mom was working at two jobs to support another family and herself and try to put him through school. He just didn't think that was quite fair. So he went into service, and he said, I'm going to see everything I can and do everything I can, you know, and I'm really going to take advantage of this. He did his basic, and then he was in Korea for a year. He came home, and I came to Washington, D.C. with him. He was stationed at Fort Meade, Maryland, in the middle of October. And on the 27th day of December, he was killed in an automobile accident. I heard somebody say, it's okay. You know, God doesn't take away from you. And that's been a lot of years ago, 1964. But God doesn't take anything away from you. He hadn't given to you, does he? No. So he'd given me that for that period of time. So I did have that to be grateful for. Well, now in that period of time, after my husband had died, and this is like about 2 years later, guess who comes into my life? I'm looking for trouble, aren't I? But I was sitting at the desk in the office where I was working at that time. I was a city clerk in this little town where I live. And this fellow came in, and he was going to do some work for the city. He was in the oil business, and so he was going out to work on the gas well that we had out there. And I, you know, when I get down and out, my face gets about this long, and that probably had looked like that for a good while because a lot of people had begun to feel sorry for me. Maybe that's what I thought I wanted at the time. Maybe I wanted a pity pot, I don't know. But anyway, that's the way I look at it now. And he gave me a little card that had the Serenity Prayer on it, and he left after talking to me for a little bit. And I looked at that card, and about 2 or 3 days later, he came back, and it had, of course, you know what it was. It was your AA card, and it had the steps and things on it, and I didn't pay too much attention to those steps, but I know I had seen that serenity prayer a lot of times before, but I needed it. And I see when I can see, and I hear when I can hear. I sit in meetings a lot of times, and I don't hear what's said, but when it's my time to hear, I hear. And I looked at that card, and I couldn't wait for him to get back to tell me what I could change in my life. I didn't want the world on my shoulders. I didn't want all that stuff I had was carrying around with me. And he looked at me just as straight, and he said, "The only person you can change is yourself." Oh, no, I've been changing people all my life. He said, "No, you haven't." He said, "You just think you have." He said, "That's what's the matter with your life. That's the reason why you got the world on your shoulders. You put it there. They didn't put it there." He said, "You have to let go of it. Let God have it." You know. But I wanted some more of whatever he was talking about. He didn't tell me he was an AA at that time, but I saw this card. But I had, my youngest son had gone with a girl whose father was an alcoholic. And she's come to my house crying a lot of times, and I would say the same things that I say, and I'll not say. I would say to her, "Look, those people are not looking at your father. They're just looking at you. You don't have to be ashamed. You don't have, they don't even know. The majority of people don't even know that. As long as you're the kind of girl that you want to be and good to yourself and you do the things that you're supposed to, keep up your schoolwork, don't let these things happen to you." I was giving her all that Al-Anon stuff somewhere along the way, that principles really that I'd learned, I guess, basically in things in my life. And I knew about AA, but that still didn't, you know, I just knew he hadn't made it in the program. He'd go and then go and get drunk, and he'd have the gun out, and he'd run them off from home, and they'd go back home, and, you know, all that stuff. But after he told me that he was in AA, he didn't say how long he'd been sober. It didn't make any difference to me. I was kind of like dumb. I guess I thought when he said he's an alcoholic, that was, whee! That was a name. They gave that drunk a name. And it sounded good. Sounded better than a drunk, doesn't it? Doesn't it sound better than a drunk? Sure it does. I tell you what it did. It gave me hope, though. That's what I'm say to you when I say it sounded good. It gave me hope that there was, you know, something there. But he kept telling me, well, needless to say, you know, he'd ask me out, and I went out, and you know what a tremendous job these alcoholics can do when they're courting you and all these things that go so beautifully, and they just do things a lot better. You know what? One of those things that he could do better than anybody else, and that was listen, and I heard Don say that yesterday. He liked me for what I was. He didn't ask me to change one thing about me. And that was tremendous. Oh, boy. We talked an awful lot about this, changing things we could and not changing things. And I could see that things were beginning to get more serious than they should be. And then I realized what somebody that drank had a lot of problems. And I didn't need another problem. Man, I was just getting all this weight off of my shoulders, and I didn't need that. And we had sort of set an ultimatum as to the time that we would make a decision one way or the other, or I made a decision, or both of us, whatever the situation might be. And I decided, uh-uh, I'm not going to do this. No. So I went, took the test for the Peace Corps, had everything all set, ready to go. And I called him and I said, "This is it. Don't come back to my house anymore." Guess how long before it was he was in my house? Almost by the time I hung up the phone. He said, "No, this is not what you want to do. No, this is not what you want to do." And he began to, you know, tell all these things. And I listened to him and I didn't go to the Peace Corps. I'm grateful I didn't go to the Peace Corps. So we decided that we'd get married. He needed me. Sure he needed me. See, I didn't know I needed him too, but I did. I was, I think about when Don said the ratio of 1 to 10. I tried to figure out where I was in that when she was talking about that last night. Apparently, ours must have been about the same level. The needs were there. But we didn't even have Alnine at that time very close to us. It was about 40 miles from where I was. But they had a lot of open AA meetings. And thank you, AAs, for allowing us at those open meetings to sit in when we didn't have a program of our own to go to. I learned an awful lot of things in there. I saw people come in that were who looked about like I did when I came in, when he came in with a serenity prayer to me and said they would, you know, be, and it wouldn't be long, they'd get sober and they'd everything would brighten up and their eyes would brighten up and, you know, life got better for them. And occasionally they'd ask me to share something that I might have to share. And I'm so grateful for that. Because we usually went to a meeting almost every night. Sometimes, I mean, it was here, there. It wasn't any problem for us to get someplace to go to meetings because he always seemed to be involved in something that was close to where a meeting was going to be. And I know now that he sort of planned things that way, and I'm grateful for that too. But we did start, we were going to a place where they had an Al-Anon meeting. But you know, I didn't need that Al-Anon meeting. I had him right there beside me. And I wanted to listen to everything they said. And I wanted to hear what they had to say. And then I wanted to, you know, give me elbow, you know. In case he didn't hear it, I heard it. We weren't hearing it through the same ears, though. I was hearing it the way I could hear it, and he was hearing it the way he could hear it. But I'm grateful for that. Well, they asked me to go to Al-Anon. I didn't want to go to Al-Anon. I was having a good time. I was really enjoying life with him. I was learning how to live again. You know, when we talk about recovery, re means I've gone back to do something that was there before, and I had had a better time in my life than what the things that were weighing me down. And I thought this alcoholic was going to do this. Eventually he did, and I was brought up to believe that you could do anything you wanted to do. And when the alcoholic drank, I said, to heck with this theory. That doesn't work. I want him sober. I've prayed for that. I've done everything I know how to do. And it's not working. What's wrong? I know today, though, that that's still true. When I got in there and did something about me, everybody else was okay. I didn't understand that. I thought I had to fix everybody. I got fixed the very first thing when I got here. Somebody tried to fix it for me. I pulled in over there where I was supposed to pull in. Some ladies, I don't know who they, you may be here, but it just struck me as being part of the program. And they told me I'd parked too close to a rock. I need to back up. I said, I'm in the right place. They're fixing it already. Today I laugh about the things I one time cried about. Isn't that nice? Isn't that nice? But I was still in the fixing situation and not really able to let go of him, but you know, he was able to let go of me. And it was such a good freedom to be me and to do the things I wanted to do and to say what I wanted to say without being upset about it. And you know, when we would get in, we used to laugh about it. We were Scotch-Irish between the two of us. That occasionally the Scotch-Irish got, you know, like this, and we would verbally go at one another. But he had enough of the program under his belt that he would say to me, we're fighting below the belt, and he'd walk out. I'd gone to where I could do that, and I'm so grateful for that. We didn't have to go into these long, heated arguments. We knew something was wrong. He'd go out and get a cup of coffee, or I'd turn and walk away. Now, I didn't do this at first. I did it as I learned how to do it. I learned it through you. The things that I prayed for, God didn't come down and, you know, stand right here and say, now, Marge, you do this and you do this. But he sent me you and you and you and you and you. He still sends me you, you and you and you. When I need something and I'm in pain or I hurt, I ask for help. and God sends people. And I need people. I need hugs, and I need encouragement, and I need somebody to say, when I'm not doing something right, get with it. Here, that's not the way it's to be. I remember talking to this sponsor of mine and talking about something is going on, and she said, you want to stay miserable? And I said, no. She said, well, change it. You can change it. I said, I don't want to. She said, stay miserable. And that's what I did till I could see how to get out of it. So there's a way for you. There's a way for you. I'm so grateful. Now, my husband drank periodically. And if he hadn't had a drink for 5 or 6 hours, he wouldn't drink again for months. It might be a year. You may not think that would... I haven't had the other kind, so I don't know. I can't compare things in that sense. But it wiped me out. And I'd forget some of the things I learned in Al-Anon. And I remember one time he said, we were going to take some friends and go to Canada on a fishing trip. And I knew from his attitude, that old hole hit my gut again. I knew he's going to start drinking. I knew he was. And guess who was so sweet and loving all the way up there? Didn't do a thing in the world, but bitch, had a beautiful trip. Bitch the whole time. Bitch the whole time. Knowing he's going to drink. I couldn't hear. See, I wasn't hearing what my sponsor told me. I just had to do that. Couldn't control it. It got out of control. I had to do something bad. But we did have a good time, but he did start drinking. And he would drink until he got so, so sick. And I'd think, how could anybody, such a beautiful person that he was when he wasn't drinking, and do all these things, why would you do this to yourself? And one day I said this to him, and I'll never forget, he looked up at me and he said, Marge, you really don't understand. I didn't have to say those words anymore because he meant that, and I knew he meant it, and I knew I didn't understand. I didn't attack my husband that had cancer. I didn't say, you son of a bitch, you. Why don't you get rid of that? What are you doing that for? That's exactly what the alcoholism was doing. But I could say those words to the alcoholic. See, when I think, would stop and think about it, but it didn't take me very long because my husband was one of these people that when you did that kind of thing, you better take a back seat or go out the back door because he could say more than you could. I remember the time now, when I say I guess I'm pretty passive and I still am, and I'm grateful for that in a sense. I didn't do a lot of arguing and I didn't do a lot of fussing about things. Our children, now Otis had two sons also, and his youngest one was graduated from high school and was going to college, not too far from us, but he wasn't home all the time. So we didn't have any children at home. And so we pretty much did things, you know, the way that we wanted to do them. And I would think sometimes of the things that I might do that would make things better for him, and in the same sense, he would do these things for me. And I knew that all of his life wasn't consumed. I mean, I knew he was an alcoholic, and I knew he was trying to practice these things, but when he would drink again, these things would come to me. But they had told me in Al-Anon that I brought things on myself. And I thought, gee, whiz, all these years these things people have piled on me, why would I pile anything else on me? I remember after being around a while and my sponsor saying to me, Marge, God's forgiven you. Why don't you forgive yourself and move on? And I thought, she said, you just keep beating yourself over the head with the same old things. You've not moved out of them. You haven't grown enough. And I got to thinking about that, and I asked God to help me with that. And when I could forgive myself, then I loved myself. I wasn't all that bad. There weren't bad things, there were just things that I had done that I didn't know better at the time. But they, for me, when I knew better, then it was not the thing for me to do. But I did sometimes choose to do it as a reflex action. I didn't act, I reacted. And this is what this program has given me, actions, not reactions. Not reactions, actions. Actions that come from within inside of me. After after a period of time, I looked at the clock up there, can't believe it. One time I decided that he was drinking a little more often, that I hadn't heard what they were saying in the program. I decided that this time when he came in that I was going to change that if he drank, and I knew he was going to drink again. The hole got back in my gut. I could tell by his attitude, I could tell by the stinking thinking he was doing, the things he was saying. He was evasive and that sort of thing, and I just knew that he was going to start drinking again. He had a lot of physical ailments. At the end, he had can't think the title of it. Anyway, it was his black lungs, what it amounts to. He worked in a coal mine in Illinois when he was a younger man. But he also had ulcers, and he had had a heart failure in a long this period of time, and things were happening to him. And I thought I really needed to take care of him, but he had chosen to drink this time, and I thought, well, they told me I'd been being too good. By being too good, I was going to take care of those ulcers he had, so when he came home this time, prior to this drinking, I would feed him oatmeal and cream of wheat, and I always was sure he got at least one full stick of butter every day because that protected his stomach. At least a fifth of whiskey a day. But I'm protecting his stomach. Now that, I'm putting vinegar in that. That's protecting. Is that, you know, the tape, there are two kinds of tapes playing up here. And you hear two tapes playing, you get mixed up. You don't know which one to listen to. You go crazy. So I decided these crazy people in Ireland didn't know what they're talking about. And I decided this time when he came in, I wasn't going to tolerate this kind of stuff. So when he came in the kitchen door, I'm standing in the, kind of in the shape of the cabinets like this. And I never had cried like that in front of him. But it had broken my heart just to think that he'd start this all over again. And I'm standing there crying. And he looked up at me as he went through, and he said, the more you cry, the less you'll urinate, and just. And that wasn't a word he said, though. He went right on through the house, and he laid down and went to sleep. But I didn't know he was asleep. Guess what I did? He hated slamming cabinet doors. He hated dishes rattling. He hated heavy walking. I nearly stomped the floor out in the kitchen. I slammed the doors. I rattled the dishes. I did everything I could do. I went and looked around the door facing. Sound asleep. Sound asleep. Didn't even know I was doing all that stuff. And I said, okay, Al-Anon, you're right. You're right. You do all this stuff to yourself. I wasn't through, though. Wasn't through. He woke up. I told him what I thought about somebody that would pretend to be in AA as many years as he had. I think at the time that he died, he'd probably been in, 19 years, and most of that had been sober years. In the time that I knew him, he hadn't had too many drinking bouts, but I was right in there with him anyway. But I just decided to tell him all these things. Oh, God, I prayed, please get him to shut up. I wasn't even saying anything by this time. I'm just listening. It's just piling on and on and on and on. And I'm listening. And he went to sleep one time, and he's saying, you son of a, and a half hour away, woke up, and he said, bitch, and went right on. A day and a half to run down. I run down in about 5 minutes. I said all I was going to say, but I really, and I said, oh, I won't ever do this again. Went back down line, and I told them I thought they'd said me do that, and they said, no, Marge, you heard what you wanted to hear. Nobody said that to you. You just thought they did because that's what you wanted to do. And you trying to lay blame on somebody else. No, you did that to yourself. Okay, I'm not going to do this anymore. And I didn't. I didn't do that anymore. I didn't have to do that anymore. He went, that particular time, he went through a terrible, terrible depression. And I was trying to say to him, you know, just One minute at a time. You're going to get through this. One minute at a time. We'd go through all that stuff. And that particular time, and I walked in the bedroom, and he had the pistol in his hand. Now, he had an arsenal of guns, pistols and all kinds of guns. I was not afraid of those, but his AA friends were. I don't blame them. Sometimes he'd lay them all out on the floor and on the coffee table and around in front of, you know, when he got to a certain degree of his drinking. They were never loaded, but they didn't know it. So if they came to help him and the guns were laying there, they'd just turn around and run out the door. That's using your head. That's using your head. But anyway, this particular time, he said to me, he said, I just can't take it any longer. But he said, I love you enough that I'm going to take you first before me. Now, you're laughing, but I took that as a comment. I really mean it. I said, I'm ready to go. I was up to here. I didn't know where else to go. I was really at a bottom for that kind of thing. And I really appreciate the fact that he thought of me first. I'm serious with you. I really was. I had a Catholic priest who was a real good friend of ours. He was worked in the comprehensive care and used to eat breakfast with us, I think just to get his head straight. He worked with alcoholics. And he'd come to our house and eat breakfast a lot of mornings with us. But he told me I was crazy to stand there and say such a thing. But you know, he dropped the gun down to his side and he said, you really mean that, don't you? And he came out of that depression. That thing went away. He only drank one other time after that. And as I say, that's the time that I took him to the hospital and he was so totally drunk. But there was when I took him this time, it was a person I truly loved. And I know when the nurse put him in the wheelchair and I had to go park, he said, see, I told you they wouldn't let you stay with me. And I said, yes, but I'll be right there. I had all the patience, all the kindness in my heart of anything you could think about. I couldn't see that man as being a mean person. I could see him as a sick person, truly sick. And I'm so grateful that you gave me that in Al-Anon. I'm so grateful for so many things that you've given me. My life has been so much better. Now, this has been about 10.5 years ago. After I went to that first Al-Anon meeting, I went in there and I thought, you know, did you ever go home and just kick your shoes off and say, oh, it's so good to be home? And you know, that's the way I felt about the things they were saying. These people know me. They know what I'm talking about. I felt like I'd been visiting in AA. You were a great host, and I loved you, and I still love you. But when I went into Al-Anon, that was exactly where I needed to be. So I started going to Al-Anon, and I loved the things that they did. And you know, I'm an avid reader. I just read anything. In fact, when I found out he was an alcoholic, I went to the library, and I read every book I could find on alcoholism because I wanted to turn that screw. I wanted to turn that key that caused that alcoholic not to drink, to help him not to drink. I must tell you then about also my oldest son, at the time of his father's death, began to drink some. This bothered me a great deal. I felt that he needed, you know, help in other directions. And my minister even said that he felt like giving him a good whipping. And I said, well, if it'd do any good, I'd say do it. But, it, you know, that's no good. I didn't know about the disease of alcoholism at that time. My son then had another child. He had two girls and a boy. His marriage was getting rather rocky, and I thought the thing was causing was the alcohol, and I still think that had a big part to play in it. He would come home, and the minute he hit the door, she began to tell him about all the things that the children hadn't done that day. And in his state, he didn't want to hear all that stuff. And she would throw a pan, and he would throw whatever he had, and, you know, they did that kind of thing. Now, I never had that kind of thing to contend with, but my grandchildren got in the way. And you know yourself that if your children get in the way, it throws a different light on this thing. And I began to want to take the children out of the way. My sponsor said, no, Marge, that's not your responsibility. You leave those children where they are. And they'll be all right. You just stand by. And I did that. But isn't it hard to stand by and wait for things to happen? Oh, God, I needed you. I needed your support. I needed you to say, yes, 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 do that. And wait. Sit and wait. Do what you can do. And this is what I had to do. This got progressively worse. And the time came when they went their separate ways. I think the hardest thing in the world for me to do was not to go get them after my oldest granddaughter and you who are the children of alcoholics, or he doesn't choose to call himself an alcoholic today, I should say, a person who drinks to excess in that sense, because you don't title people, that she was the mother. She took care of the other two. And I didn't think that was fair. And she talked about this and how they had to go and hide. And I thought how awful this was. And again, I wanted to go. And my husband said to me, he said, "Marge, no, you can't do that." He said, "I want to do that as much as you do. I love him as much as you do." They had that kind of relationship. But anyway, they did go their separate ways. But just prior to that, and this was after my husband died that they separated, but they were in the process of this at the last when he was so sick. My mother was also in the hospital in Nashville, had surgery 3 times that year, and I was with her a great deal because being an only daughter, she wanted me and I wanted to be there. And through trying to let go of that situation, which was much harder for me to let go of a child than it was the spouse. Much, much harder. That was my flesh and blood, more my responsibility, I suppose, or whatever the feelings were there. And it was much, much harder for me to let it happen what needed to happen. He came in the house one night. This was prior to Otis's death. And he was so, so drunk. And he came over and he stood over me in the chair and he told me what a ornery, poor, no good mother I was. My son did not talk like, he'd never said things like that. And you know, I didn't hear that son saying that. I heard what came out of that bottle causing those things to come out of his mouth. Thank God for Al-Anon. Had not have gone clear down through the basement and maybe never come out. I don't know. But I didn't have to do that. When he finished, he said, "You got anything to say?" And I said, "Yes. God loves you and I love you." And you can imagine what he said. He threw his arms up and he said, "God." He said, "The whole ceiling could fall in, you wouldn't say anything." And I said, "Yes, I can say I love you." He went out the door and the tires squalled as he went out the driveway and around and up the corner. And this is when I really turned him over to God. And I haven't had that load on my shoulders. Now, don't misunderstand me. I still love him and I still care. And I still love that family and I love all of them. But I let God have him. And the burden went away. And I talked to this about my husband, with my husband about this. And he said, "You know, Marge, this is the first time I ever realized how much my drinking hurt somebody else. I always thought I hurt worse than anybody else." But he said, the pain in there for him, "I wish there was something I could do." I said, "Now you know. Now you know." He did get home and he called me back and he said, "Mom, I'm home and everything's okay." And I'm grateful for that. In the meantime, after Otis died, my ex-daughter-in-law at this time was going to move out of the state. She was going to take the children. The oldest girl refused to go. She said, "I'm not going. I can't take care of Mama and Bridget and Teddy." And she said, "Grandmother, can I come and live with you?" And I said, "First, we have to talk to your mother and daddy. We don't want a situation where if you don't like what I'm doing, what your mama's doing, what your daddy's doing, you just jump from one to the other." We straightened this all out, and she came to live with me. So God sent me my girl. I guess she must have been in her, this was her sophomore year of school. She finished school. We've had a truly good relationship. This girl still lives about 4 miles from me. The closest to any of my family that lives to me, my son lives in E-Town. He's remarried, and yesterday was his little boy's 7th birthday. So I've got 2 grandsons, 2 granddaughters, and 5 great-grandsons. Sons. God's not, still not through me. Maybe he thinks I need to, you know, boys along the way or something. The AAs tell me that I also need another alcoholic in my life. So if there's any of you out there, here I am. No, what they tell me is that I'm too hard to please now because most of the people that I know who are out there in that world don't see things like I do. Their values are different from mine. So I really don't communicate with those people that well. Now, don't misunderstand me. I have a lot of friends out there in other places. I do other things other than in Al-Anon. But it's because that you've helped me to do this. God's had me in his pocket ever since I came into this world. And I think he still got me there. And like I told you, I may fall out, and I may not do the things that you tell me to do, and I don't even always listen, as I told you, to my sponsor. I don't even always say the things that you want to hear from me. But I feel like that I say the things that God would have me say. I have so much gratitude in my heart that one of the ways that I wanted to do, one of the things I wanted to do from the very first theme, when I first got the first thing, I wanted all those people who came in down on to get some of this, and so I started cramming it down their throats. And you know what they did? They spit it right back out. They didn't want it yet, but I wanted them to have it. That was my way of sharing. I've always been that kind of person, as I told you, and I continue to be, and I think that's the reason why I'm in service today. I can reach out a little farther and give a little more. Monetarily, I get the same pay that all of you do. Just exactly. We kiddingly said in our last board meeting that we'd all like a raise. Zero to zero. But that's where it is. When you give, you talk about unconditional love and the things that you give. You know, the more that I'm in service, and I know that it has really helped me to be able to put principles above personalities. Also, when I came in here and became a part of, you are my family, you're the people who love me, who I can come to. And it's like I say, I looked around and I can lecture without fears, because I'm talking about something else. But when I talk to you about what's inside of me, that's not easy. And I do have fears. The first fear is that same old thing comes back to me, that maybe you're not going to like me, and maybe I've said something that you won't like. But I hope that if I've said something that you don't particularly like, they told me that I needed to hold up a mirror and look at myself. And they said, don't look in a cracked mirror either. If my mirror is cracked, I hope it's not. But I remember my first, when I had finished my 3 years as delegate, and one of the DRs who had, as those people who have been in service know how grateful they are for those other people that help you to do the things that you need to do. She looked at me and she said, Marge, I've really seen you grow in the last 3 years. She said, there's so much love in your eyes. And I'll say it to you exactly what I told her. I said, it's simply what you've given me coming right back to you. And I firmly believe that. For me, when I began to grow, is my favorite page in the One Day at a Time book. And that's on page, it's June 13th. And it says, the beginning of love is to let those you love be perfectly themselves, and not to fit them into the image that you would have of them. Otherwise, you love only yourself, the image of yourself. Al-Anon gave me that. And what a freedom. What a freedom. I don't have to be responsible for those people. I have to be responsible for me. I do have to be responsible. My program tells me that I have to consider your feelings. Where your freedom begins, mine ends. And I have to remember that. I don't have the right to step all over your toes. I don't have a right to do those things. I've got somebody I'm sponsoring, I might step on their toes pretty hard. But I know in the long run they're going to love me, because I loved them enough to tell them what helped me. And that's what you've done for me. You've given me this beautiful program of outline that I don't ever have to be alone anymore. I've done a lot of traveling. I was telling Carrie last night, I've sure done lots of sleeping around since I've been in service. I've even had the privilege to be in Europe and to be in meetings that I didn't even know what the people were saying. But it's a language of love, and that's all I needed. I needed a hug. And I needed to know they were there, and I'm grateful today that better than 26,000 groups are functioning out there, that I don't ever have to be alone anymore. I can call some of you. I went to Denver. I was going through Denver, and I was going to be there 7 hours. My group said to me, what in the world are you going to do in Denver 7 hours? I said, I'm going to call Al-Anon. I called the information service. They gave me 3 numbers. Nobody was there. I called back. They said, get in a cab, go down to this building. There's AA and Al-Anon meetings all day. I went down there, and guess what I did? I met some beautiful people in Denver. I got ready to leave, go to the airport. I said, I've got to get a cab. And this guy said, get a cab for what? And I said, well, I'm going to the airport. He said, oh, no. And he looked at his watch. He said, you got time to see Denver. So he took me around to see Denver. Now, where else would you do that? Would you go into a strange city, go with somebody's, you know, into a group like that and say, you know, those things? No, you wouldn't. I came back and I said, see what I told you? You don't ever have to be alone. If you don't have that little thing, getting in touch where you can go up to any place and call information service and find out where there's some meetings or something going on, I suggest you get one. I think it's been a beautiful weekend, and I want to thank you again. The people in West Virginia are simply, I think we're just an extension. I know some of my ancestors came from this way. And not only that, I feel really quite at home. You have a lot of counties that have the same names ours do, and as I was born and raised in Logan County, Kentucky. So we do have a lot of things. We have the mountains, and we have the coal fields, and best of all, we have the alcoholics. And I love those alcoholics, and they're what's brought me here, and I'm grateful for that, and I'm most grateful for Al-Anon for what they've given to me. I want to thank you again from the bottom of my heart. Thank you.